Welcome to The Appleseed, the storytelling podcast from BYU Radio, where your family can gather for great stories from great storytellers in every episode. Stories bring us together, and we hope the stories on the show will spark memories and thoughts for you that you can share with the people you love. I'm your host, Sam Payne. You know, some fantastical stories feature characters stumbling into new worlds. I mean, think of the Pevensey kids, Peter, Edmund, Susan, and Lucy, stepping through the wardrobe into Narnia in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, or Meg and Charles Wallace and Calvin finding themselves on Camisots in A Wrinkle in Time. You know, there are real-life adventures, too, that can require you to navigate outside the world you know and are familiar with. You got to find your way in unfamiliar places and with people who may seem very different from you. And today, Bill Lepp brings us a true story of a time when he was living in Germany as part of an exchange program in high school. Bill has made his storytelling mark as a tall tale teller. We've brought you a few of those tall tales here on the show. But this story is something different. It's just a real-life story about navigating a world far from home. Here's Bill, recorded live in the Appleseed studio with a story he calls Lessons from East Berlin.
When I was in high school, when I was about 16 years old, I got offered the opportunity to go to Germany as an exchange student for a year. And we were living in Dayton, Ohio at the time, and I signed up. It was kind of a prestigious thing. I didn't know it because I don't pay attention to things. For example, just show you how little I pay attention to things. In 1994, I was accepted to Duke University to go to graduate school, and my wife said, "Oh, good, we can go to a basketball game." And I said, "Does Duke have a basketball team?" That's how aware of the world I continue to be. So it was this prestigious thing where each senator in the United States got to pick two kids to send to Germany, and each Bundestag member in Germany got to send two kids to the United States. And so I went, and I was in this little tiny town way in northern Germany. It was north of the city of Flensburg. I was in a little tiny town called Ringsburg. It was an agricultural town. I lived on a dairy and a swine farm, and if I stood on top of the hay barn, I could see Denmark. That's how far north I was. And there weren't really any kids in the neighborhood that were my age. I was living with a host family. I had a host brother, but he was 11, and I didn't want anything to do with that. So I went to high school every day, but it was a long way to high school. And of course, you know, those kids, I didn't really ever learn German because the German kids knew seven languages since they were in kindergarten. But I did my best to learn German, but I was lonely. This was obviously way before the internet or cell phones. There was no way to communicate with people at home except to write letters. Maybe once a month I called my parents. And on one of those calls, I called my parents and the phone rang and I got the doo-doo-doo. This number has been disconnected. And so for a month I didn't know where my parents were. And later I got a letter that they had moved to Philippi, West Virginia while I was in Germany. So anyway, most of my contact with the world back home was this slow letter writing process. And I did have some good friends who sent me wonderful letters. My friend Emily, I don't know why, but she just transcribed the lyrics to Blister in the Sun by the Violent Femmes. That was the whole letter. And it was beautiful. And then, so I went to visit another exchange student, a guy named Ken. He lived down near Hamburg. And I went down to his place, and he had found a payphone. Young people, in the old days, you would go out in the world, and on the wall of, like, a gas station, there would be a phone, and you would put a dime or a quarter in it, and you could call people. And if you called people outside of your local area, you had to pay additional money to make that call. If you called people from another country, it cost a fortune. But Ken had found this payphone. You could put a dime in it. You could call America. Well, you put a 10-pfennig coin in it. You could call America and talk as long as you wanted. And it was just, it was this amazing escape. I called all my friends back home. I called all the girls that I knew, both of them, and they talked to me for minutes before they hung up. And then finally, I thought I should call my parents. And so I called my parents, and my dad got on the phone, and I was telling him about this amazing phone. And my father had what we call in my family a gross papa thought. A gross papa was my grandfather. It's German for great father. Doesn't have anything to do with this hygiene. But gross papa would just have these ridiculous paranoid thoughts sometimes. I met a kid from Texas, and I told gross papa, I met a guy from Texas. He's my friend. And gross papa said, keep your hand on your wallet. So that was the word that gross papa lived in. Gross papa also, when he was 18 years old, lived in the Ukraine. The Russian Revolution broke out, and he fought with the White Army against the Red Army and was betrayed and had terrible things happen to him. So he had grown up in a world where not everything always worked out for the best, and so he sort of had a pessimistic view on things. But so I told Dad about this phone, and he immediately had a gross papa thought. He said, they're going to track these numbers. They're going to find you, and they're going to charge us for this call. And I was like, go hide behind the couch, Johnny Fever. Thank you for laughing at that obscure joke. And I hung up, because I could be a little flip. I was on a different continent, and I wasn't coming home for 6 months. So at the end of our journey, well, I guess about halfway through our journey in Germany, they decided to take us as a group, the 50 of us United States students, to East Berlin. Again, young people, quick history lesson. After the Second World War, Germany was divided into four sections, British, United States, French, and Russian. The capital, Berlin, was divided into those same four sections. And then at one point, the East Germans built a wall between the Russian section and the United States, French, and British sections, and they locked those people in there. You couldn't go. It was a communist country, a communist city. So we went to Berlin, the free part of it, and for one day we got to go into East Berlin. And they sat us down, they took us in the room, there were all these big guards, and they told us the rules. The first thing we had to do was take a $20 bill, an American $20 bill, and exchange that for 20 East German marks, which was like changing an American $20 bill for a wet Kleenex. That was about the exchange rate. And then they told us we could only go in this one section of the city. We were not allowed to leave that section of the city. We couldn't take any photos of any police, government officials, military things, weapons, any military buildings, any government buildings, which meant we couldn't take any pictures. And we had to be out by 5 o'clock, back at the gate at 5 o'clock, and we had to turn in any money that we hadn't spent. And we couldn't give any money. We couldn't just give our money away to the people. So they told us these rules, and me and my buddy Pete and Tracy and Jenny, we went in to East Germany. At that time, I was wearing red high-top tennis shoes. Red, I was sympathetic to the Soviets. And then I had on a United States Army overcoat, which I had liberated from the Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps at my high school, complete with general stars and U.S. Army insignia. Tracy was about this tall, and she had a mohawk that was, I'm not kidding, 2 feet tall. Pete was of Polish descent, and at that time, Poland was fighting for its liberation against the Soviet Union. They had a movement going on called Solidarnosc. So Pete had these pins that said Solidarnosc, which meant solidarity, and then one, there was an arm raised up from it that had a Polish flag on that. So Pete had one of those giant Solidarnosc pins on. Jenny was relatively normal compared to the rest of us. We went in to the city. We immediately left the area where we were allowed to be, got on a train, left all of East Berlin, went out into East Germany, like 45 minutes. Pete walking up and down the aisle of this train, handing out $5 bills and Solidarnosc pins, and Tracy and Jenny just chatting with the people, and me leaning out the windows, taking pictures of military bases, missile launchers, tanks, troop radars, anything. We get off the train, we go in this train station, we walk in, we're 16 years old, we're Americans, we're like, we're here to save you. You know, we thought that they were gonna throw us a parade. And the waitress said the East German equivalent of what do y'all have? And we sat down and we ordered eggs and soda. And this old man came up to us and he goes, do not drink the soda. Here is beer. And he gave us beer. And then we got on the train and we rode back to East Germany. And I still had most of my money. And I was wandering around. And I thought, what am I going to spend this money on? And I saw a bookstore. And in the window of the bookstore, there was this beautiful poster. It had a giant, the German lion on it, walking around the Brandenburg Gate. And it said, Berlin, 750 Jahre, which means 750 years of Berlin. This city was celebrating its 750th anniversary. At that point, my country was barely 200 years old. And I thought, what a cool poster. I want that poster. And I went in the bookstore, and I went up to the clerk. You know, the little bell went ding, ding over the door. And I said, in German, thank you very much, I would like to buy that poster. And she said, in English, thank you very much, that poster is not for sale. And I was like, oh, no, I'd like to buy it. And she was like, it's not for sale. And I was like, I mean, I didn't say this out loud, but I was like, I'm an American. You understand, we can just get stuff, right? And she was like, the poster is not for sale. And the door went clang, clang. And I turned around, and here was this East German soldier. And this guy was like out of Hollywood. He was 6.5 feet tall. He was a rectangle. He was dressed in olive drab. He had like a Sam Brown belt with a gun on it. And she goes, the poster is not for sale. And I was like, oh, the poster's not for sale. And so I go back into this East German bookstore, and I'm looking at books thinking, maybe I could buy something from my grandfather about the Russian Revolution from the East German perspective. Perhaps he'd like that. And this wasn't like a Barnes & Nobles. This wasn't where you could just walk around the books and just kind of drift from section to section. This was like an old library where there were just stacks of books. And when you got to the end of a stack of books, there was a wall and there was no way out. And I was at the end of one of those stacks of books when essentially the lights went out. And I turned around, and there was that East German soldier walking toward me, opening his coat. And I had a gross papa thought. I thought, it's the phone. They found out about the phone. It was a KGB plant, and now I'm caught, and they're going to take me and throw me in a gulag in Siberia somewhere. And he's getting closer and closer. He's reaching in his jacket, and I thought, no, he's just going to murder me. He's just going to kill me right here, and there's nothing. I'll just be gone. No one will ever know about me. And he gets right up in front of me, and he opens his jacket. He pulls out a rolled-up poster, opens my jacket, puts the poster in it, and says, the poster is not for sale. And he turns and he walks out of the store. And we're supposed to be back at the gate at 5 o'clock. And it's now a solid 5:30. And I thought I should get going. And so I was hurrying there, but I wanted to save some of the money. Now, the German coins at that time were made. They weren't made out of metal. They were made out of some kind of plastic. I don't know, probably fancier than plastic. Anyway, I wanted to keep some. So I stopped and I took off my giant red Converse tennis shoe and my sock, and I put a bunch of coins in my sock because no one had ever thought about that smuggling method before. And I put that bag on, and every time I took a step, my foot went ding, 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 and I was passed out a little bit of money to some poor people. And then I started thinking, if I don't have any money, they're going to be suspicious, so I should have some money to turn back in. So I stopped again. I took off my shoe, took off my sock, got some of the coins out, and I had a 5-mark piece, which was about the size of an American silver dollar, and then a 5-pfennig piece, which is like a nickel, and it's about the size of a nickel. And I got to the gate, and I turned my money back in. I said, here, I have these 2 coins. And the guard picked up the 5-pfennig coin, and he said, you take this with you. And if you put it on a railroad track, when the train comes by, it will be as big as a 5-mark piece. And I thought, all right, great. And I guess what I learned from that is mostly that if you get to people and you can get past their uniforms or past your stereotypes about those people, sometimes you can find real people underneath.
That was Bill Lepp with Lessons from East Berlin. You know, listening to Bill's story reminds me of a day long ago when I answered the phone, and on the other end was my pal Carlisle Potter, the bass player in a long-ago jazz quintet for which I was the singer. We called ourselves the Utah Jazz. I mean, why not, right? I mean, anyway, Carlisle asked me over the phone if I wanted to go play some music in Tokyo. And I was silent for a second, and then I said, the one in Japan? Well, Yeah, the one in Japan. And a few weeks later, I was on a plane bound for the Far East. And when we weren't playing music together, I was touring Tokyo, guided by Carlisle, the bass player. As it turns out, he had spent a lot of time in Tokyo in his life. He knew all the great things to show me, all the great food to eat, all the great stuff to do. And what a place! Sidewalks dizzy with traffic would suddenly open onto ancient and silent Shinto shrines, the world around them disappearing behind lush curtains of trees. Acres of crowds moved in patterns through the markets surrounding immense Buddhist temples, pausing only long enough for the smoke of the temple's holy fires to wash over them. I'd turn on the TV in my hotel room to find nothing on but the Sumo Nationals, a contest steeped in endless years of tradition and bristling with a kind of sacred energy. It was, for this hometown Utah guy, a little like visiting another planet. And traveling there reminded me a little bit of, well, this may seem silly, but it reminded me of what it must have been like to be born, to come and live on planet Earth, a place where I don't know the language or customs, a place full of strange foods and colors and smells. Just like I had Carlisle in Tokyo, I had good and patient and experienced guides as I came to live in the world, in the persons of my parents and teachers. Guides who, like Carlisle, struck a balance between teaching me where to walk and allowing me to walk where I would. Guides to equip me with good counsel, who tempered their guidance with patience. Listen, I value my independence. I love to go where I will, discovering things for myself. And like Bill in his story, I treasure those adventures. But I really do thank heaven for the good guides that have blessed my life, helped me to see things I wouldn't have seen, to go where I wouldn't have known to go on my own. Good guides in this amazing world. I don't know how I would have survived the trip without them. And that's where Bill's story took me. Where did it take you? And who will you take along? You know, our next story is from Geraldine Buckley, who, as a girl, was obsessed with stories of exciting new worlds and longed for the kind of mystery and adventure she found in her favorite books. And that longing led her to some fun places. She'll tell you about one of them. Here's Geraldine Buckley with a story called Tatton Hall.
When I left prison, I became a professional storyteller. And I really did leave prison. I was the Protestant chaplain at the largest men's prison in Maryland. And when I left, I thought, what on earth prepared me for such a job? Because I am creative, I'm a free spirit. I never thought I could be bound by bars. So I thought about it, and I remembered a story in the Good Book, the one where the shepherd boy David fought the giant Goliath. But before that marvelous day, he was trained with lions and with bears. He fought both of them. And I thought, what were my lions? What were my bears? And I knew that I was going to have to go back into my misspent childhood in England a long time ago. So I'd be grateful if you'd all join me on a magic carpet ride as we do whisk back to England. And so when I was young, I loved to read, absolutely loved to read. I would read things over and over and over again. I started off with fairy stories and then with folk tales and then adventure stories. I read them so many times that I wasn't quite sure whether something had happened or whether I'd read about it. Well, when I was 8, my mother said to me, Geraldine, it's high time you got a library card. And I love that card. It was, I used to bike down to the library and it opened a whole new world to me. It meant I could gather up armloads of books. I could put them in my bicycle basket. I could bike home and then I'd read them all afternoon and all evening. And when my mother would come in at night to tuck me in and say prayers with me, she'd say, good night, darling. And I'd say, good night, Mummy, and she'd turn the light on, and as soon as she'd gone, I'd get out my flashlight and I'd start reading under the sheets. Well, when I first got that library card, my favorite author was a woman called Enid Blyton. The ones that I really liked when I was 8 was an adventure series called The Famous Five. That was two boys, two girls, and a dog called Timmy. And they always spent the holidays together, and they always wanted nice, quiet holidays. But they always managed to stumble into adventures. And those adventures seemed to surround hidden caves and ancient houses and secret passages. And then I discovered a transatlantic heroine, Nancy Drew. She of the Chichen hair and the blue sports car. She knew if you found a secret passage that all sorts of mysteries could be solved. And I wanted to find a secret passage. Now, I had read in the Junior Encyclopedia in the library that secret passages in England were mainly found in Elizabethan and Tudor houses. That didn't faze me. I went over every inch of our 1950s house, knocking on the walls, tapping on the floors, just hoping that I would find a secret passage that everyone else had overlooked. But it never happened. So I was delighted. I was thrilled when our form teacher, Miss Lemming, said that our class was going to go on a field trip to an ancient house, Tatton Hall. Oh, I was so excited. But on the day, Miss Lemming, now she was a lay teacher. This was a convent day school. She was very encouraging to the girls normally. On this day, though, she was in a really bad temper, which was unusual because she liked to encourage us girls. She'd say things like, "Girls, you must have the courage of your convictions. If you've got a goal, go for it." And then she loved Shakespeare, particularly Henry V, and she'd quote bits of it. She'd say, "Once more onto the breach, dear friends, once more, or close the wall up with your English dead," or something like that, she'd go on. But on this day, she really was in a foul temper. In fact, she said to us, girls, she said, "Reverend Mother has said that this class will not let the school down. So if any girl at all is caught getting into any kind of trouble, there will be serious consequences. Do you understand me? Serious consequences." Well, my friend Mary said to me, she said, "What's got into Miss Lemming?" She said, "If she carries on this way, we're going to have to change her name. We're going to have to call her Miss Lemon." Well, we weren't going to let Miss Lemon's bad temper ruin our enjoyment of Tatton Hall. And oh, when I got into the library of the place, I couldn't believe it. It had floor-to-ceiling bookshelves on each wall. I read afterwards there were over 10,000 books in that room. Now, between the books and the public, there was a velvet rope that segregated you. But I knew that if somehow I could lean far enough and touch the spines of those books, that all the knowledge contained in them would suck into me by osmosis. And I knew if somehow I could just touch the bookshelves, that I'd find a hidden catch, and the whole of the front of the bookshelf would come open, and behind there, there'd be a hidden room, and beyond there, there'd be a secret passage. I just knew it. Well, I wonder who's got to dust those books. That's not a very nice job. It was our Miss Lemon. And she shooed us out of the library up a broad staircase. And at the top, there was a door. And on it, there was a plaque. And it said, "The Lemon Bedroom." "Ooh, look," said Mary, my friend. Look, they knew we were coming. That's where they named that bedroom after our Miss Lemon. Well, inside the Lemon Bedroom, there was this enormous four-poster bed. It was huge. It was all intricately carved. I had never seen a four-poster bed before, and this one was huge. It had about 7 mattresses on it. Well, as soon as I saw those mattresses, I knew that that was the bed that the Princess of the Pea had slept in. And she'd had a terrible night. She tossed and turned. She was black and blue in the morning because of that pea under the bottom mattress. I just knew it. I wonder who's got to make that bed. And imagine turning those mattresses. That's not a nice job. It was our Miss Lemon. And she shooed us out of that part of that room, of the Lemon Bedroom, up a narrow staircase. And it had a plaque on it that said, "The Servants' Quarters." And we went into a corridor, and off it was a small room. And there were only 2 pieces of furniture in this room. There was a chair and there was a spindle. As soon as I saw that spindle, I knew that that was the spindle that on her 16th birthday, Sleeping Beauty had pricked her finger and the whole of Tatton Hall had gone into 100 years sleep, and it had stayed that way until the handsome prince had fought his way through the undergrowth and he'd awakened Sleeping Beauty with true love's kiss. I just knew it. Well, I don't think much of the servants' quarters, and clearly they didn't think much of the servants. It was our Miss Lemon. She shooed us out of that part of Tatton Hall into a much older and medieval part, which was really nice. But what I liked was that right by there was a tiny cottage. And it just had one main room. And in there was a fireplace. There was a rug in front of the fireplace. On the rug, there was a table and a chair, and there was a china cabinet. There was a plaque, though, over the fireplace, and I went to read it. And it said, "Beneath this rug, in front of this fireplace, there is a secret passage that goes between here and the local church. It was built during the reformation of the monasteries to help save priests' lives." I looked at it. It said, "There's a secret passage here in this room." Well, I looked around to see where Miss Lemon was. Well, she wasn't there, and nor was the docent who had been sitting at the entrance to the room. They must have gone off to the little teacher's and little docent's room. So I said, girls, come and help me. There's a secret passage here in this room. Well, Mary went really peculiar on me. She said, "I don't think we're meant to because it's hidden." I said, "Of course it's hidden, Mary. It's secret. But it's like a scavenger hunt. That when you find the clue, you've got to go for it." And then Daphne went really peculiar on me. She said, "I don't think that Miss Lemming would want us to do it." And I said, "Oh, no, Daphne, I think you've got it wrong. I honestly think Miss Lemming would want us to do it. I really do." You know what she'd say? "Girls, you must have the courage of your convictions. If you've got a goal, go for it." And then she'd quote that Shakespeare thing. She'd say, "Once more onto the breach, dear friends, once more, come and roll that carpet up." That's what she'd say. So the girls helped me. They took, together, we got the table and chairs off the rug, and then I went over to the china cabinet. And it just had a whole lot of old plates and cups and saucers in there. And there was a plaque that said that these were Wedgwood and Minton and Spode. Oh, just a whole load of old china. So I got two girls on one side, two on the other. Daphne was on one side and I was on the other. I said, "Come on the count of three. One, two, three." And we lifted it up and we got it off the rug and put it back on the floor, and everything rattled a bit, but it was fine. No, it was fine. So together we rolled up the rug, and there in front of the fireplace, there was a trap door. And in the middle of that trap door, there was a brass ring. Oh, I went over to it. I started to pull. It moved just a tiny bit. I knew I was going to have help. I said, "Mary, get behind me. Put your arms around me." So I said, "On the count of three, one, two, three." We pulled and it started to move. We pulled, but I knew I had to have more help. So I said, "Okay, Daphne, come and put your arms around Mary." So there was me, and Mary had her arms around me, and then Daphne had her arms around Mary. I said, "On the count of three, one, two, three." We pulled and it moved. We pulled. "Girls, what do you think you're doing?" It was our Miss Lemon. She said, "Who is responsible for this?" I said, me. She said, "Geraldine, come over here and explain yourself." I said, "Well, you see, Miss Lemon, Miss Lemming, you see, there's a plaque on the fireplace and it says that there's a secret passage beneath this rug. And I thought because it said it, we had to find it." She said, "Geraldine, you have behaved like a hooligan. And if you carry on this way, you will end up in prison." Now, I don't think on that particular day, Miss Lemming thought I'd end up being the chaplain in the prison. But she didn't manage to ruin my sense of adventure. So I just want to warn any of you. If you are kind enough to invite me to your homes and you look away for a moment and then look back quickly, I might just be knocking on your walls and looking under your rugs, because you never know when you will stumble into adventure.
That was Geraldine Buckley with Tatton Hall. Have you ever longed for an adventure and found one? Or not longed at all for an adventure and found one anyway? Have you ever had a good guide you were grateful for? Were you ever surprised by someone who looked like a stranger but wound up being more of an ally than you imagined? I bet you've got some stories. We hope you'll share them with the people you love. In fact, we hope you'll share the stories with us. We might share them on a show. You can tag us on social media or send us a message at theappleseed@byu.edu. That's theappleseed, all one word, at byu.edu. We want to thank Bill Lepp and Geraldine Buckley for sharing their stories with us today. You've listened to their tales. Now it's time to share some of your own. If you love the Appleseed, check out Wink, Stories for Better Bedtimes. It's another BYU Radio podcast we think you'll love. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.